and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Well, greetings, Remnantitos. As you might have gathered instantly, your dear leader, the Commissar, Jonah Goldberg, is not with you today. And so who do you get in his place? It is but I, a simple country pundit, Chris Steyerwalt, happy to be with you. And this is The Remnant from the Dispatch and Dispatch Media. And sometimes, like an eclipse, stories align, the news aligns, and the things that I like to talk about, people are talking about. And one of the things that I like to talk about is how dumb demography makes America more divided, more upset, less willing to change, more siloed, more resentful. And we do a lot of it, right? In my work, I spend a lot of time with political demography, and I have watched how everything from the use of the word evangelical has corroded people's faiths and their understanding of all of that stuff, to how people have mislabeled Hispanic voters to the detriment of both parties. It's a doozy. But the one, of course, that I feel the most attachment to has been the recent obsession. And when I say recent, I mean going back to, 2015, obsession with what those hillbillies are up to. What are the whites doing? What are those white people out in the country doing? And as somebody who grew up in Ohio County, West Virginia, off of the North Fork of Short Creek, and somebody who spent a dozen years reporting from Southern West Virginia, I got to watch with real dismay as the national media descended on Appalachia and the Rust Belt and different places and basically interrupted everybody's dinner to say, before you finish that, I want to know, was it more your racism or your economic despair that made you vote for Donald Trump? And it was, I call it Hillbillies in the Mist. It was not cool. And then there was a book that came out just this year. It's called White Rural Rage. And it's about as nuanced as the title would suggest. It's from a political scientist and a journalist, Paul Waldman and Tom Schaller. And it is an absolute hit of oxycodone to the neural center of sort of elite East Coast, West Coast people who believe that the problem in America is upset hillbillies. And I was lamenting this. And then I read a piece. Where did I read it? I read it in The Atlantic. I read it in The Atlantic, which is not the place that you generally say, well, I'm going to get a hot dose of reality for the elites. But then it was so good. And the person who wrote it, his name is Tyler Austin Harper. He is a contributor for The Atlantic, and he is also a professor at Bates College. And he is our very welcome guest today. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And I think the audience should know that you are you at Bates? Am I talking to you from Bates College right now?
No. Well, I live in southern Maine, about 40 minutes from the college. And I'm actually on sabbatical right now. So I am on a research leave. But I return to Bates in the fall.
Well, people should know that you are wearing a flannel shirt. And you are vibing Bates. You have the correct Bates College
Good.
Energy. So people should
Good.
Know that.
I'm glad.
Okay. So talk to me about you are an environmental scientist, right? You teach on that issue.
I teach in an environmental studies department that's interdisciplinary. My PhD is actually in literature. So I teach environmental literature and film, basically. So novels and films about the environment. But I, work with scientists and social scientists.
I will submit that very few people with English degrees from Haverford and masters and PhDs in literature from NYU are not the... These are not the people who typically I say, this guy is going to really have his finger on the pulse of what rural America is up to.
Thank you.
T- tell me your story. How did you get to be you?
So I grew up in South Central Pennsylvania in a town called Mechanicsburg, which is about 20 minutes from the state capital of Harrisburg. Which when I was growing up was a little more rural. It's suburbanized more and more every year, and more, you know, farmland and everything else is disappearing in many parts of America. But my family on my mother's side is from Matthias, West Virginia, in Hardy County.
What?
Yeah. So.
Okay. Right on.
Yeah. So I have, you know, Appalachians on one side of my family. On the other side, some folks are from Huntington County, Pennsylvania, which is also very rural. And, you know, I grew up hunting and fishing. I still fish very seriously. And so my family is from rural places. I've spent a lot of time in rural places. I also come from a place, like I said, Mechanicsburg has become more suburban, but it was really hit very hard by the opioid crisis. I graduated high school in 2010, which is really when the opioid epidemic started peaking. You know, I went to school with a lot of people who ended up in rehab or, you know, deceased during that moment. So white rural rage was frustrating to me for a whole host of reasons. And, you know, I'm somebody very much on the left. And so seeing my at least a quadrant of my team kind of dunking on rural people who are often, you know, disproportionately poor and disadvantaged and have been screwed over by deindustrialization, everything else just, you know, made me angry immediately.
I'm here. Speaking of which, here's what Paul Krugman wrote about that book. This process and its effects are laid out in devastating, terrifying, and baffling detail in White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy, a new book, blah, 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 blah. I say devastating because the hardship of rural Americans is real, terrifying because the political backlash to this hardship poses a clear and present danger to our democracy, and baffling because at some level, I still don't get the politics. It reminded me of Thomas Frank wrote a book in 2004, and it was called What's the Matter with Kansas? And the argument there was, why don't poor people vote for policies that would help them? They're being tricked by culture wars to vote for vote for people who are really against their interests. And just taken as a piece of political argumentation, saying to people, you dummies, why don't you vote the right way? And you're being fooled, and the things that you believe are false. One of my other core beliefs is Barack Obama was talking about places like your hometown when he was asked. He was at a fundraiser in Marin County in 2008, and it was treated as this big gotcha moment because he was asked why people are supporting Hillary Clinton and not him. And he said, look, the jobs go away. Things get bad and people, and he used the phrase, cling to their guns and to their religion. Obama wasn't attacking those people. He wasn't saying, hate those people. He was saying, take it easy on these people. Give these people a break. They've been through a lot. So the Krugman piece really crystallized to me that kind of thinking, which we've been living with now for quite a long time, is still very much alive and well.
Yeah, I think that's completely true, you know, and I think that is that was the point Obama was making, right? That these are people, you know, one of my frustrations, I think, is that, you know, I am absolutely not saying, and I talked to you know, a lot of experts for when I was writing that Atlantic piece, and I don't think any of them are saying, trying to give anyone a free pass, right? Like portray rural America and rural Americans as this, you know, halcyon Arcadian space or whatever. Like rural people and rural places have problems like any other demographic, you know, but this book struck me as just being entirely incurious about why some of the problems that, you know, they were pointing to, and in some cases erroneously pointing to, but nonetheless, how that might arise, you know, like, I mean, they pay lip service to, you know, they talk about deindustrialization briefly and the opioid crisis briefly, but then they go on to, you know, basically blame character deficits for, you know, the reasons that, you know, rural America has problems, and they're just so racist, they won't vote for the folks that are going to help them out, the Democrats and the progressives and so on, you know. Like I said, I think, you know, there's just little curiosity often about, like, we can dispute to what extent these attitudes exist, but say these problematic attitudes exist, there's very little curiosity about, like, how that might have arisen or in response to what, you know? And I find it deeply frustrating. And I don't think it's a productive or interesting way to think about rural people in rural places. And there's just not, there's a lack of extending grace that other kinds of populations in different parts of the country get, right? Like, I don't think, you know, the authors have kind of responded to their critics by saying, you know, all of these people are just apologizing for rural folks and want to portray rural places as these paradises on earth without any problems. Yeah. And that's not true at all. No one is saying that, right? They're just saying that, like, other populations in the U.S., you could not write a book openly demonizing. It wouldn't be okay, you know? And I think it's just a question of, like, why can we not extend that same courtesy to people living in rural parts of the country?
Yeah, the book Black Urban Rage would have a very specific audience, right? That would not be...
Used that exact example in an early draft of the article. Like, you couldn't call a book Black Urban Rage. Like, people would melt down. And if you did, you certainly, a mainstream press... If a book like that was written, it would be written by an expert in Black politics, and it would have been fact checked to death, right? And like,
well, these were not experts.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You latched on to, for me as a politics person, from a research perspective, the single most offensive part of this book was, what's a rural person? What constitutes a rural person? And Schaller and Waldman decide that that's probably going to be limiting, right? So this looks very much like a reverse engineered book. They had an outcome that they wanted to get to, and then they go backward and find statistics that support it. And sometimes rural is a census designation for rural. Sometimes it's really small town people that they're talking about. Mm. Sometimes it's this, sometimes it's that. You write the following. It would be like undertaking a book-length study demonizing Irish people, refusing to define what you mean by Irish, and then drawing on studies of native Irish in Ireland, non-Irish immigrants to Ireland, Irish Americans, and people who took a 23andMe DNA test that showed Irish ancestry, and Bostonians who got drunk on St. Patrick's Day to build your argument about the singular danger of the Irish. It's preposterous. The research here is poor, very poor.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the huge problems with the book. You know, like, there would have been a defensible version of this book where they might say, like, look, researchers use a lot of different ways to categorize rural. We think that doesn't quite capture rurality as a phenomenon for various reasons, right? Like, rural might be a cultural phenomenon that's not just about a geographic reason and region. And for that reason, we want to think about rural in this more expansive sense that might include small towns or deindustrialized small cities or whatever. You can make a case like that, right? But they don't make that case. Instead, they just, as you point out, just cherry pick different studies, all of which are using different definitions of rural, which, you know, means they're using radically different populations and treating them as the same. A really important distinction in the research that I get into in my article is the distinction between objective rural residence and subjective rural identity. In other words, being in a place that is geographically coded as rural according to the U.S. Census or various metrics that political scientists use, or identifying as rural, whether or not you necessarily live in a rural place. And one thing research shows is a ton of people who identify themselves as rural or who think they live in a rural place do not, right? And there are a lot of reasons for that. They might be in a place like Mechanicsburg, where I grew up, that used to be more rural, then became suburban. But their memories of it, their like associations with it are of as a rural place. They might be someone like me who has family from very rural places. And so they have these connections and think of themselves as rural. They might be people that hunt and fish or that are evangelical, and they have these cultural affiliations that are coded as more rural, but they might live in suburban or even urban areas. I mean, there are people in New York City that identify as rural for a host of reasons, right? And those are often people who like move from places like Kentucky or Tennessee. Yeah. They move to the big city, but they still ID as rural. So when you use these studies that are moving back and forth between, you know, you're citing one study that is using rural identification, you're using another study that's using geographic rurality, you are mixing and matching populations wildly, right? And you're losing all of your whatever insight you could possibly get if you had just picked a definition, you know? So that was one of the things that was really frustrating about this book. I mean, it's a book about rural America, and they don't define what they mean by rural.
I'm talking to you from the southeastern quadrant of the District of Columbia. One maximally urban place in America. In 15 or 20 minutes, I could be in, I could go down the Accokeek Highway into Prince George's County, Maryland. And once I got to Andrews Air Force Base or 2 minutes south of there, it would feel very rural, right? It would, and the people who live there drive pickup trucks. There are gun racks. It is a rural country kind of energy that's around it, but they live in a medium, large size city metropolitan area. And as you say, the you could take the example of when Fox and Friends on its show has a creased cowboy hat country musician come play on the Fox News Plaza on 6th Avenue in New York. If you were to say to those the people there, like, are you rural or urban? Man, we're rural. We're with the country people. We're with the good people. We're with the salt of the earth people. And a lot of this is, there is a longstanding belief, and it has lived on the left and it has lived on the right, that country people, and this is true throughout history, and I assume it's true in every culture, it's certainly true throughout Western history, which is the people of the soil, the good people, the rural people are the real people, that these are the good people, the people of the earth, as opposed to the elites, the cosmopolites, the urbanites. And so certainly there is as much untruth in the false lionization and positive othering of rural America, which mostly takes place on the right in America today, used to take place on the left. That's just as unfair in its own way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think what I and anyone else who thinks about this issue seriously would advocate for is just treating rural people as people in all their complexity, right? Which means there are good things and there are bad things and there are great things about rural culture and there are, you know, troubling or problematic things. They're like any group of people living anywhere in the U.S., you know? And we understand intuitively about other groups. You know, if you're a progressive-minded person, you're supposed to understand that, you know, sweeping generalizations about groups of people are always wrong, right? Except, you know, in the case of the hillbilly, right, then it's totally fine to, you know, traffic in these broad sweeping generalizations about their evil, or on the flip side, as you point out, on, you know, on the right, to traffic in these narratives that there are no problems in rural areas, there's, you know, no racism or no issues whatsoever, and there's just good, hardworking people, right? And I think, you know, what I think the sensible among us are fighting for is just to admit the complexity, right? These are complex places with complex people that are like any other region of the country, you know? And I think the same courtesy, you know, without either mythologizing in a positive or negative direction is what's required.
Back to your piece. The more significant problem with white rural rage is its analysis of the threat of political violence. A core claim of the book is that rural Americans are disproportionately likely to support or potentially commit violence that threatens American democracy. Quote, violent or not anti-democratic sentiments and behaviors come in many forms and emerge all over the nation, Schaller and Waldman claim. But rural whites pose a unique threat. The section where the authors attempt to defend this assertion, however, contains glaring mistakes. And you put together another round of base stealing, where what constitutes a threat to democracy and what constitutes a proclivity towards political violence is undefined and cherry-picked.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is the section of the book that has the most glaring problems. I mean, the point about not defending rural sort of pervades the entire book. But in the political violence section, it's not only in chapter six, but it's mostly in chapter six, where they're trying to show that rural people are more likely to have anti-democratic attitudes and are more likely to support or potentially even commit political violence. It just has mistakes all over. So, I mean, there's, for example, they point out to these violent extremists who tried to kidnap the Democratic governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, and, you know, try to position them as these ruralites who are, you know, conspiratorially minded and unhinged, except those guys are from suburban areas. They point to the Pizzagate gunman who showed up to the Pizzagate pizza parlor with an AR-15 and, you know, kind of frame him as this like rural guy who was filled with rural rage, except yet again, he is somebody from a suburban area, a metropolitan area. So they're constantly taking these real examples of actual issues, but that are coming from suburban or metropolitan areas and framing them as like, oh, this is rural. But on top of that, the studies they cite frequently point to the exact opposite conclusion, which to my mind is the most egregious problem with this book, right? So there are two different kinds of errors they make. One, in a couple of different places, they say, here's this study. They cite a study allegedly about rural sheriffs that are anti-democratic, et cetera. Or they cite a study about, showing that rural people are more likely to support violence over democratic deliberation. Except if you read the studies, and I read almost every study in this book that they cite, if you read the studies, neither of those studies are about rural sheriffs, and they're not about violence or democratic deliberation. So in other words, they say a study supports their conclusions. That study isn't even about the topic that they're trying to address. It's about a totally different topic. So that's one category of error that crops up repeatedly. But another is they keep citing studies that they say shows that rural people are the most likely to support violence. And that study concludes the opposite, that it's suburbanites or metropolitan people. This happens in two different places. One article they cite, to show it's rural people, if you look at the article and it says clear as day in a crystalline paragraph that, most of the violence we see, right-wing violence, is coming from suburban areas. Another example, they cite Robert Pape, who's this political scientist at Chicago who works on terrorism, both domestic and international. And they cite his study of January 6th. And they say it points that rural people are disproportionately likely to, support violence, whatever. And that study does say rural people are slightly more likely than average to support, returning Trump by force. That is true. They get that right. What they neglect to mention is the overwhelming key finding of the study, which is that overwhelmingly metropolitan men are the most likely to be have these insurrectionist tendencies, or the overwhelming number of people that participated in January 6th. In fact, the very slide they cite to support their claim, Schaller and Waldman's claim that rural people are the most dangerous Americans, says in huge letters that the threat is mainly urban, and that 73% of people who have these right-wing extremist, support for violence views are in cities or suburban areas. So they really just butcher the research.
Okay, so let's take a second to hear from our sponsor, Aura Frames. Longtime listeners know I'm a big fan of Aura Frames. I've gotten them as gifts. I've given them as gifts. I sent my daughter back to college with one so she could look at many, many, many pictures of her cat and I guess her parents as well. So if you're looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life, Aura Frames are a beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. I can attest, it is very easy to use, very intuitive. You don't have to read a lot of documentation. And it's just like you load the app and it says, what pictures do you want in your frame? And you put them in your frame and you can change them and you can set the settings to whatever you want for how long the pictures stay there. It's pretty idiot proof. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, AuraFrames.com. Use the promo code REMNANT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
You write, the authors fail to explain why we should be more worried about the 5.67 million hypothetical rural insurrectionists than the 15.33 million who live in urban and suburban areas, have more resources, made up the bulk of January 6 participants, and are the primary danger, according to Pape's Pops?
Pape, I believe. Yeah, Pape's, he's the Pape's Chicago report. Guy.
Yeah, yeah. And even though I don't know how to pronounce his name, he is very useful and very good. What struck me is in this othering, in this this villainization, there is the desire, and we obviously see it on the right with
with the disdain for cosmopolitan elites and disdain for cities and the narrative that cities are all hellholes filled with despair and disaster. But excusing essentially Democrats from having to engage with these voters, right? Because the takeaway, the sort of inexorable takeaway is it's too late for these people. These people out here, and there is, they do express pity for people from places like the North Fork of Short Creek or Mechanicsburg. They have pity for these people and their what they've been afflicted with, but they're not, it's not a book about, so what should we do to help? It's a book about these people are seriously dangerous and seriously bad, so we must unite against them, right? We must unite against these people. And what a terrible thing to say about your fellow Americans, especially when, and this is, you know, I'll tell you a story that I've told many times, but you've never been subjected to it. But it's a story of I was in a grocery store in 2016 here in Washington, D.C. And a woman who recognized me from television came up to me and she said, Chris, you have to tell these people they can't vote for Trump. It'll be a disaster. And I said, well, let me tell you about the holler over from the holler where my parents built their house. And that's Windsor Heights, West Virginia. No jobs, opioid addiction through the roof, out of wedlock births at 70%, and just a catastrophe. And if I go tell those people that it'll be a disaster if they vote for Donald Trump, what are they going to tell me? You're too late. You're too late. You should have come here 25 years ago when deindustrialization was starting. Maybe we would have had an interesting conversation about democratic norms and constitutional conduct, but we're sort of over it right now. And this is not, I make no excuse for Donald Trump in saying this, but certainly you understand why people who feel alienated and feel othered are not receptive to arguments about maintaining norms when those are norms that they feel they're disadvantaged by.
Yeah, you know, I think the other thing too, so in white royal rage, they will say, if it was just about the economy that, you know, these rural people voted for Trump, when he, you know, didn't bring back the coal jobs, in fact, when more coal jobs were lost over the course of administration, that would have changed their voting habits. But it didn't. Rural people voted for Trump more in 2020 than they did in 2016. So Schaller and Waldman say that's proof that their motivations are racism, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I mean, I think it's two things. One, on the one hand, it's very obvious that the average sort of mainstream normie Democrat has immense disdain for rural American rural places. And if you don't think either party is going to improve things for you because you've watched the last 5 decades of everything getting worse, the Republicans making things worse, the Democrats making things worse, you really aren't expecting things to get better. It's just, you know, an FU vote, basically, right? And you're not going to vote for the people that treat you with absolute disdain. So I think that's part of the picture. But I think the other part of the picture, and I do think in Schaller and Waldman's defense, they allude to this, is that rural places are more culturally conservative. They don't earnestly expect anything to get better in terms of the economy. So they're just going to go with a group where they have some cultural resonance with. But, you know, I hear what you're saying about the kind of the grocery store experience. In 2016, in January of 2016, not long after Trump was elected, I was in back in my hometown, and I was in a grocery store, a Wegmans grocery store in Pennsylvania, and I was looking at the beer section, and there was this guy beside me with a big red hat on, you know, and I'm sitting there, and he keeps like glaring at me. Well, what I was interpreting as a glare, right? And I'm like, oh no, what is this? You know, like this the angry Trump guy is like, you know. Finally, he looks at me and I'm holding a 6-pack of beer and he points at them and he goes, are those any good? And I was like, oh yeah, they're definitely good. And I was sitting there interpreting, you know, that this is this guy who's like filled with rage and blah, blah, blah. And I had this moment where I was like, I've grown up in this area my entire life. I've had nothing but largely positive experiences with all the, you know, conservative rural folks I grew up with. And this sort of Trump panic right around 2016 had really deformed how I thought about, where I grew up, and it was a moment where I really had some clarity about the damage and the dehumanizing that, can accompany the kind of MSNBC cable news narratives that a certain kind of Democrat is fed on a regular basis, even as I am, someone who votes for the Democrats. I think it's dehumanizing and dangerous, and it's just breeds a lack of curiosity about other kinds of people and extending empathy and grace,
The National Opinion Research Center, speaking of the University of Chicago, National Opinion Research Center recently came out with a survey on Americans' shared beliefs. And there were some deltas between Republicans and Democrats on specific things, but on basically the core tenets of the American creed, on the Bill of Rights, on the core issues, the numbers were astonishing, right? 90%, 89%, huge super majorities of Americans shared their point of view about the importance of free speech, about the importance of individual rights, about the importance of these things, these creedal ideas about America. This was Black Americans, white Americans, Latinos. This was everybody. And the numbers are so big. But if you were subsisting on a steady diet of political media, you would have already come to the obvious conclusion that America is so hopelessly divided. I went to see Dune.
Mm-hmm.
That was long.
That's what I heard.
But my eldest son wanted to see it, and God bless him. And one of there were two cultural experiences that were important in this for me. One was they had a trailer for a movie called Civil War prior to Dune.
Yep.
That in which basically the way the trailer portrayed it was hillbillies are at war with normal people from the cities and suburbs, and America is ripping itself apart. And they even had like a guy holding an AR with like a toothpick in his mouth doing a Cool Hand Luke vibe, talking to these afflicted urbanites. I thought, oh my gosh, like, what are you people doing? This is not the discussion. This is not a helpful discussion. And then the other great epiphany of that was we were out by Dulles Airport, out in that part of town where part of the area where we don't usually go. And I realized that my son, we went to the Texas Roadhouse.
Mm-hmm.
My son had never been to a Texas Roadhouse. He did not know the many multifaceted joys that I had grown up with going to things that were restaurants in the parking lots of shopping malls as a fine dining option. Where we live, he doesn't know about stuff like that. He's not familiar with it. And so the two things I took away from this experience were, number one, there's a lot of money to be made in terrifying people about the coming collapse of America. And number two, it's really important to go to places and take your kids and take yourself to places where you're going to interact with people who are culturally different than you and get to taste and see more different stuff, even if it's a strip mall.
I totally agree with that. I think, so particularly people in the media environment, and I think this is true on both the right and left, are so confined to cities and urban centers that they are really, really out of touch with large swaths of the country. And they're just perfectly happy to fantasize that we are on the eclipse of, on the cusp of a new civil war and a sundering of, right and left in some kind of violent crescendo. And I just, I find that deeply unhelpful. And I think, so many people just sit around either watching Fox News or watching MSNBC and are, greeted by image after image of either rural hellscapes or urban hellscapes in this, the sense that we're, the country is a powder keg. That's just, as an academic, I travel all over for, conferences and whatnot, including plenty of rural places and all over the South. And, I think most places I've been, whether it's, Detroit or Kentucky, you people are more or less pretty similar. They're generally nice and kind and are enjoyable folks to have a beer with, you know, and that doesn't mean that there aren't cultural differences and, you know, distinctions between different kinds of places. That's absolutely true. But I think your point about most people being, you know, pretty fundamentally decent and agreeing on the, you know, the big picture of what's important in American society, I think that's the rule rather than the exception. And I think the media is very good at focusing on the exceptions, you know, and convincing us all that, you know, that A24 movie Civil War is a prophecy rather than a bit of entertainment.
All right, now I'm going to get weird for a second and you can feel free to not come with me, but
please,
I have a belief, which is, and I wrote a book about what has happened with the media and how the atomization of media leads to siloing. And there's lots of political research on the Great Sort that took place in the 1990s, where we obliterated a lot of the regional distinctions in our politics, right? We lost liberal Republicans, we lost conservative Democrats, and people got sorted basically. And that's one of the big problems in our politics today, is that we're too well sorted and there's not enough apostasy in both parties to create interesting coalitions. And it's also left us with a lot of very close elections, and having a lot of very close elections in a row is not helpful. Every once in a while, you need a good toad floater to come in and really wash everything out, reset things, right? After 1996, people weren't like, maybe Dole is the answer, right? It's helpful every once in a while to have a little bit of a reset.
Yeah. Get on the same page.
So we got sorted, we got atomized, we got sorted. And what the other thing that I would add to that is that there's been a leveling, which is to say we've lost a lot of the distinct regional culture. We've lost a lot of the sense of place and regionality. You can see it in dialects and accents. You can see it in foodways. You can see it in a lot of stuff, that there is a homogeneity that has swept across the country in the past 30 years that has taken away a lot of our interesting, worthwhile distinctions that made places unique and da-da-da-da-da. I believe that perhaps one of the consequences of that is that people glom on to political identities, glom on to membership in political tribes as a replacement for the sense of self that comes from being part of a place. Tell me I'm crazy.
No, I think that's right. My favorite book on trying to explain the Trump phenomenon is actually by a conservative, even though I'm a far left guy, Tim Carney, his book Alienated America. And one of the things he
posted, my colleague, my friend, my homie. Yeah.
I think that book is great. And I disagree with the sort of economic pieces of the book, but that's neither here nor there. And it's, you know, his thesis, as you know, in that book is that if you look at places where people have, say, high religiosity but low church attendance, so they report being very religious but not actually going to services, like these groups of people who have sort of high ideological affiliations but lack of a kind of communal, you know, whether it's community centers or like shared civic institutions in their community, those are the people who tend toward the extremes. And he was talking about, you know, Trump voters in the right. I think it's equally true of the left, right? Like if you are a person who is pretty alienated from your community and from civic life, and the, you know, there's the decline of clubs and organizations and everything else, and all you have is your politics as an identity, right? Of course, that lends itself to this kind of extremism. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I think I, even as a person of the left, why I have a lot more, I'm willing to hear out conservatives, and I immediately didn't like this book. I grew up, my first job was at a gun club in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, working at a sporting clays range. And, you know, I definitely was the only, you know, liberal person there. I was definitely the only brown guy there. But I was treated amazing. And those people, you know, took me under their wing and, you know, sold me a competition grade shotgun at like 25% of the price because, you know, they wanted to get a kid into the sport. And, you know, and later on, I got really involved in competitive bass fishing. I was a member of different fishing clubs and stuff. And, you know, which were also mainly, you know, filled with Republicans. And I think there's a lack in this country of regional flair, as you point out, but then also both mixed intergenerational and mixed political spaces, clubs, organizations, whether it's the church or bowling alleys or fishing clubs and whatever. And I think when you have that sort of decline in regionality coupled to the lack of spaces where people of different affiliations can come together, I think it's a recipe for disaster. And then are the places in which we're most passionate end up being social media and politics. And those aren't certainly good for the country.
Those are bad replacements. Man, a Tim Carney reference? I mean, come on. This is what I'm talking about.
They're going to take my leftist card from me.
No, Tim is an apostate conservative. He's cool. He's not. I don't think you'll be seeing him at the next Turning Point USA conference.
Yeah, that wasn't the vibe I got.
I think you're cool. Tim just wants everybody to have 50 kids and not put their kids on travel basketball teams.
Yeah, I'm excited for his new book. I ordered that.
It's good. It's good, and you will enjoy it. The last thing I want to say about this stuff is Donald Trump's greatest area of support in the 2020 election. Where was it? It wasn't rural America. It was small cities, small towns. That's the heart and soul of MAGA is not out in the bucolic countryside. The heart and soul of MAGA is in places like where I grew up, Wheeling, West Virginia, 20,000 people in the Rust Belt. That's 75%, 80% Trump votes. That's where you find the hardcore stuff. And I think we come back to the base stealing of what's rural is whatever we say rural is across America. And you've seen it in Pennsylvania. You have family in West Virginia. There are a lot of little cities that have withered, right? And they're still there. There's not a huge reason for them to be there. My hometown has done okay because it's only an hour from Pittsburgh, and it's got hospitals and it's got some higher ed. So it's served as sort of a point of service for the region. But you could drive all across this country and you find these little cities of 15,000 people, 20,000 people, 30,000 people. And it's been rough, right? Because there aren't enough people to provide good services. There isn't a tax base and a population base to provide good services. You don't feel like you're part of city life. You're not part of city life, and you're isolated. And I think that feeling of resentful isolation is a powerful driver of this stuff. And that's not a rural problem. That's not about rural America. That's about what happens with economic transition and places that were boom towns of an earlier time that have, and no offense, have outlived their usefulness as economic centers, and yet still they're there.
I think that's totally correct. And that was my biggest frustration with this book, is that it's pointing the finger at rural places and people who are disproportionately economically disadvantaged and poor, and B, not really the source of the problem. And the book is just tapping into this long American tradition of stories about scary hillbillies. I mean, this goes back to the 19th and early 20th century when coal companies and big energy companies would, you know, if you look at media representations of Appalachia going back to the 19th century, early on, Appalachians were portrayed as sort of these kindly folks with maybe they play the banjo or have some, you know, cultural oddities, but they're, you know, they're good, kind folks. And then once, you know, the extraction economy kicks off and sort of big coal and everything else moves in, then these media narratives begin to portray those people as dangerous and violent, et cetera. Why is that? Well, because it was to the advantage of coal companies who wanted to legitimate the idea that, well, we can blow the tops off mountains because these people are trash and, you know, you shouldn't care about them anyway, essentially. And, you know, that moves through the mid-20th century with Deliverance and everything else. And White Rural Rage is just the latest installment of, you know, hearing banjo sounds and conjuring up, you know, fears of the hill people when the problem is not, you know, the people in West Virginia, it's Tom Schaller and, you know, their neighbors, right? Other suburbanites and other people in small cities. You know, it's not Llano, Texas, or these places in the middle of nowhere.
I have an alternate theory about the hillbillies in the mist phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it is that when the frontier closed at the turn of the century, closed with it. Have you ever seen the movie Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood?
Yes, many years ago, but yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's a fabulous movie, and there's a character in it who is an East Coast writer who is out to tell the story of English Bob, and then he decides that he really wants to tell the story of Little Bill, the heroic sheriff. And those books were called Penny Dreadfuls,
mm-hmm.
right? And they were new printing technology had made it possible to crank out these, and rising literacy rates in urban centers had created this huge market for crap, right? For romanticized. And so the stories of the West were the most popular. After the frontier closed, where would you go to tell stories of wild and woolly and murderous and sexually libidinous life? Well, Appalachia was a real good one, was a real good place to go. And if you'll let me obsess.
Please.
The story of the Hatfields and the McCoys. Right. You could tell that story as two noble houses of Verona. You could tell the story. It's a very human story, right? You have two groups of people and they are they're tightly confined by space, fighting over limited resources, and they get into it with each other. But if you were to read the Penny Dreadfuls, what's the story? Incestuous hillbillies fighting over a pig. And you get my favorite, of course, the Bugs Bunny hillbilly hair cartoon. So this version of the violent, sexually unmoored rustic is a very appealing thing. There was we'll call it apsploitation movie that was made in the drive-in era, and it's called Common Law Cabin. And the tagline was dirt floors and steam heat. The idea of the backwoods, that part of America as a wild, libidinous, crazy, dangerous space. I mean, I watched every episode of the TV series Justified.
Mm-hmm. Justified's great.
Yeah. It's a great series. And it's dabbling with a little of that, right? It's dabbling with a little of that, but ultimately shows people who live in that part of Kentucky as humane, decent, good people, not different from other people. But there is always a desire for where's the place, where are the people that we can look down on and where we can create a construct of, and they're beyond the law. They're outside of normal life. They're these other people.
Yeah. You know, and I think even when you try to tell a more complicated story about those parts of the country, the like popular imagination just metabolizes it yet again as this narrative of scary hillbillies. I mean, I teach Deliverance every semester, and, you know, in Deliverance, you know, you have the scary hillbillies at the beginning who menace the guys going down the river or whatever. But at the end of that movie, one of the final scenes is they come out of the river after having undergone this horrifying ordeal, and they're taken in by a sort of nice group of hillbillies who cook them dinner at this nice lodge, and everyone sits around the table family style, and then one of the suburbanites kind of starts crying, you know? And that end of the movie is clearly like unpacking that, you know, like sort of setting aside that myth that the suburbanites came in with, that though these are scary hill folks, and you have this like actually, you know, if not quite a heartwarming ending because the film is still quite dark, at least this moment that ends on real humanity. And, you know, the sheriffs that come to fish those guys out of the river, it's a black one and a white one. You know, it just blows up this myth of these scary backwoods, you know, racially homogenous, you know, folks in Appalachia. But that's, of course, not how we remember Deliverance. We remember it as this, you know, I hear banjos and we, you know, the pig and everything else. Yeah.
Poor Ned Beatty. Poor Ned Beatty.
Yeah, poor Ned.
Before I turn you loose, I want to ask you about one other piece that you wrote that was so good. And I didn't know I was going to get to talk to you when I read this piece and shared it widely. And the headline is Polyamory, the Ruling Class's Latest Fad. You're twigging here off of another book. It's a book called More, a Memoir of an Open Marriage by Molly Roden. Just give listeners just a little overview of this interesting, the Sam Bankman-Fried polycule. I think brought a lot of Americans into proximity of something that we hadn't thought much about before. What did you learn?
Yeah, so there had been earlier this year a lot of coverage in, you know, glossy magazines. New York Magazine ran a whole issue on polyamory that was part like a story and part how-to guide. This book, More, came out. There was a New Yorker piece on it. But More is by this woman, Molly Ronan Winter, and it's a narrative or a memoir about her open marriage. Reviews in the Washington Post and Financial Times and everywhere else tried to sell this book as a tale of sort of empowered girl boss feminism. And, you know, she's exploring her sexuality and blah, blah, blah. And it's a tale of female empowerment. And I started reading the book, and the book is really actually quite tragic. I mean, it's really a 300-page cry for help where this woman is basically, I won't go as far as to say tricked, but in a certain sense, pretty close to tricked into opening her marriage by her husband. She meets this guy at a bar who wants to sleep with her, and she tells her, her husband finds out about it, and she doesn't want to sleep with him. But the husband keeps pestering her, you got to sleep with this guy, you got to sleep with this guy, I'm really into it. Finally, she does, and then he says, okay, great, we're going to open our marriage, and I'm going to start sleeping with my ex-girlfriend, which she was not what she anticipated. She's like, oh, and they never even have a conversation about it. He kind of just, you know, dictates it. So the whole memoir is just her sad tales of moving from sort of encounter to encounter with these strangers she meets and being treated poorly and constantly wanting to leave the open marriage, but her husband kind of continues to convince her to stay in it. And to me, I read the, you know, I was shocked reading it after reading the reviews because it was very clear that this was a sad woman who was being emotionally manipulated, who was actually a cult survivor, which is one of the crazy details of this book. Her mom had indoctrinated her into a cult when she was a young person. So this is someone with a lot of baggage that was not only clearly taken advantage of by her husband, but by the publishing industry and all these outlets that were covering this book in glowing terms. But what was interesting to me about it was what I called therapeutic libertarianism. So there's this idea that we are all like our own little startups, and you know, we need to focus on personal growth, and we're all on an inner spiritual journey, and we need to try new things because we're on this, you know, we have to have a growth mindset, right? And it's this way of treating people like little corporations, and we have to grow, and our, you know, psychological fulfillment must always increase like the GDP. And I really understood her and the kind of polyamory trend in these elite spaces in New York and California and everywhere else is just part of this mindset where people are locked into this idea that we have to keep pursuing new experiences and there should be no limits on anything. And that's how you'll achieve happiness. And I think the lesson most reasonable readers would get out of More is that that kind of mindset often does not lead to happiness either in marriage or in life.
The counter book should be entitled Enough.
Exactly.
How contentment and gratitude can make you a happier person. I want to just read this one paragraph from your piece. It was so good.
Oh, thank you.
In his 1978 bestseller, The Culture of Narcissism, Christopher Lash argued that American narcissism should not be understood as simple self-obsession. Narcissism is a survival strategy. If we are fixated on finding fulfillment and endless self-reinvention, it is because our own inner lives feel like the only thing most of us have control over. The therapeutic cult of personal growth is a response to external problems that feel insoluble, a future that feels shorn of causes for hope. Very well said, sir.
Thank you.
And I'm very grateful for your work. I'm very grateful for your flannel shirt. I'm very grateful for your time. I very much appreciate you. Keep up the good work, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks so much. I look forward to it.
Well, it serves Brother Goldberg right for leaving me in command of the Mighty Podcast, because you know we were going to talk about hillbilly stuff, and we were going to talk about deliverance and all that jazz. It was bound to happen. But I hope you enjoyed it. Jonah will be back next time. And until then, I'll see you next time.
No, you won't. This is my podcast.